Right. So I'm going to first explain what I mean by small. Small means really small on the one Halo term. Okay. So I'm going to focus on what we can learn from the one Halo term in a cluster. Now, in this conference, we have heard a lot about sub-Halo abundance matching and relatively little about HOD and basically nothing about CLF. Shame on you. And the reason is that the sub-Halo abundance matching has a number of advantages over these other techniques. I mean, for one thing, for example, there's almost no parameterization required, other than maybe a scatter. The assembly bias that we heard about is basically you get it for free if you abundance match onto a simulation. It's all in there. The same thing with Halo occupation bias. The fact that a number of sub-halos depends not only on Halo mass, but also on the formation history of the Halo. It's all in there for free. Radio segregation of sub-halos. I had a paper last year where I showed that basically sub-halos are segregated with respect to every sub-halo property you can think of. So if you link galaxies to some property of the Halo, you will get segregation for free in sub-halo abundance matching. The fact that the number of sub-halos does not follow exact Poisson statistics, it has non-negligible effects, okay? That's taken into account for free. So all these things sound like all you want to do from now on is just put galaxies into a simulation with one recipe or the other, and you're good. But this, of course, is only as accurate as the simulation used, and that's what this talk is about. In particular, I want to understand, that's how I set out, I wanted to understand sub-halo disruption. If you look at any simulation, like Bolshoi, dark matter sub-halos disrupt by the bushes. Okay? If you look in the surviving fraction here of sub-halos as a function of the accretion redshift of 1, only about 35% survive to redshift 0. 65% of them disrupt. Okay? And the question is this disruption real, or is it a numerical artifact? And if it is real, I just want to understand physically what is doing it. And one of the first things I did was to look into Bolshoi simulation and look at the demographics of sub-halo disruption. So I identified sub-halos, the snapshot, before they disappear from the catalog, okay? AKA they disrupt. And what I'm plotting here is two statistics. Here is the instantaneous radius of the sub-halo with respect to the center of the host. Distribution in red of all sub-halos, and in blue the halos the moment they disrupt. And what you can see is disruption preferentially occurs very close in at about 10% of the virial radius. And that makes sense physically. That's where the tidal field is strongest. That's where you get a tidal shock, pericentric passages. So that sounds to be okay. Another thing that's kind of funky is this distribution of the accretion redshifts. And if you look at the ones that disrupt, you see a pronounced peak here, and then a valley, and then a second peak. This peak at about 0.15, that corresponds to the subhalos that are currently at redshift 0 experiencing their first pericentric passage. Okay? And this then means that there is a significant population of subhalos that disrupt during the first pericentric passage. These are still basically pristine NFW halos. They just come in, nothing much has happened. They get a tidal shock, and apparently they disrupt. And I'll argue that that ain't supposed to happen. Okay, so what are disruption mechanisms? Disruption mechanisms people talk about in the literature are tidal stripping. You just strip material off, and maybe if you're stripping off, you strip the thing to oblivion. Tidal heating, where it basically means really the fast impulsive change in the potential at pericentric passage, or due to sub-halo encounters, which sometimes goes by the name harassment, and maybe numerical overmerging. So let's first think about, can stripping cause disruption, pure stripping? And it was a very influential paper in that respect. It was by Erica Yoshi in 2003, who showed that if you take an NFW halo and you instantaneously remove mass from the outskirts, you can be left with a remnant that has positive binding energy. In fact, it's true, okay, for an isotropic NFW halo, whenever this truncation radius is less than 0.77 times the scale radius of the NFW, this thing that remains in the center has positive binding energy. So Eric then suggested, oh, this probably means then the sub-halo will spontaneously disintegrate. And this is, in fact, an idea that has been implemented in a number of papers on trying to model sub-halo evolution. It turns out this is completely wrong, for a simple argument. Although the total binding energy is positive, you don't know the distribution of binding energies. And in fact, the distribution is very broad. Most particles still have negative binding energy. There just is a tail to very large binding energies. Those are the particles that at the moment that you take all this matter away are having this first pericentric, or not the first, having a pericentric passage. Okay. A little bit later they come outside and they go like, where is the rest of the halo? And they just take off. Okay. So those are the unbound particles. But most of the particles still have negative binding energy. They just go, they re-virialize, and they survive. And we've tested this with numerical simulations. So where we instantaneously truncate a halo, okay, this is in units of the scale radius, so this is this 0.77. Okay, to the left of this, the remnant that remains immediately after that stripping has positive binding energy. This is the initial mass inside that NFW halo, inside that truncation radius. And then simulations after 50 gigayears in red, forget the blue. Basically, there's a little bit of gray zone here. That's the stuff that actually streams out. Those are those particles that fly out basically immediately. And immediately, within no time, this thing re-virializes. And no matter how far I truncate the damn thing, there always is a remnant that survives. Okay? So purely stripping and removing the outskirts doesn't cause disruption. What about tidal impulsive heating? So in order to figure out what that can do, I do an analytical calculation where I look up in Bolshoi what are the properties of subhalos at accretion, orbital energy, angular momentum, concentrations of host and subhalo, and I integrate along that orbit, and I calculate using impulse approximation how much energy, delta E, do I dump into my subhalo during first periscentric passage. So just integrate one radial orbit. Okay? And for that, you use a beautiful model by Gnadin, Hernquist, and Allstriker, okay, which is extremely accurate, by the way. Highly recommend it. And what you get is this distribution of delta E, the energy that you dump in during first periscentric passage, in units of the binding energy. Okay, so this is one here. So to the right of this, all these guys, you dump more energy into the subhalo than the original binding energy. And again, you might be inclined to go like, whoa, disruption. Right? Well, if that were true, then about 72% of all subhalos at first periscentric passage should just blow up. Now, there are some that blow up at first periscentric, but not 72% of them. There would be no substructure, basically. So the reason is that this is just a stupid thing to do. For the same reason, you should not just look at the total energy. You should look at how is it energy distributed over the particles. Okay? And impulse approximation tells you the particle, the energy goes as R squared. So the particles in the outskirts, okay, that don't need much binding energy to escape, they get a lot of energy. The particles in the center that need a lot of energy to escape get nothing. Okay? So if you actually do this particle by particle, and you ask, how much energy does each particle get, and how does it compare to the particle's binding energy, you can work out what fraction of them will be stripped off. And the corresponding distribution for that is this curve. You see that even if you dump on average a few times binding energy into it, you only strip on average about 25% of the mass off. In fact, you can dump 100 times as much energy into the subhalo as its binding energy, and you still are left with 20% remnant. You only strip 80%.
Is that iterative?
No, this is the first periscentric passage. I just do one tidal shock.
Iterative unbinding. So once you unbind the stuff on the outskirts, it gets unbalanced?
Yes.
You calculate the potential based on the...
I don't do anything because I do a single impulse. So I just calculate during the impulse. I know. It is, and I've tested this against simulations. This is in perfect agreement with simulations for fairly radial orbits. Very good agreement. All right. So then I said, okay, let's start doing some simulations. Let's run actual simulations, idealized simulations, where I take an n-body NFW subhalo, put it in a static potential, okay, and let it go and see what happens. Okay. Well, it's been done many times before. So here you see an example. There's a beautiful thing going around on a circular orbit. This is at 10% of the virial radius. Okay. So you zoom in here, density profile. Okay. The radial velocity dispersion. This is the original one. You see you're left with a very cold nugget, but the cold nugget remains for 22, 23 gigayears, two times the Hubble time. Who cares? The thing is, you know, you can do circular orbits. The nice thing about circular orbits is that you don't have any tidal shocking. You have a static tidal field. You can purely focus on the tides, okay? And then you can do very radial orbits to look at the tidal shocking. And we have run now about several thousand of these simulations, okay, to determine under what conditions does physical disruption occur and under what condition does numerical disruption occur, okay? We have varied the number of particles, the softening length, everything else that goes into a simulation with the numerical parameters to determine that. And this plot sort of summarizes it. Okay? And for example, if we go to a circular orbit at 10% of the virial radius, that's the radius where most of that disruption occurs in the simulations. Okay? And I integrate, and I integrate, and then I found that if I went to a larger number of particles, I got a different answer, and I changed the softening length, and I got a different answer, and we kept running more particles and different softening length. until we finally reach convergence once we use 10 to the 7 particles and a softening length of 0.003, and it's in units of the scale radius of the NFW handle. Okay, and then I get this black line. Okay, and once I know what the converged answer is, I started running different numbers of particles, 1 million, 300,000, 100,000, 30,000, different softening lengths. And what you see is two things. First of all, you see a lot of what the hell is this? These blue lines, those are 10 different random realizations. The only thing that differs from one to the other is the random seed that I use to set up the positions and velocities of the particles. That should make no difference. It should be like running your simulation on Monday or Tuesday. Well, it does make a difference, and it's dramatic, even with 300,000 particles. And it took me for a long time to figure out what's going on. It's actually a very simple process, and it's a runaway instability that's driven by discreteness. You have a tidal surface, which is like a semi-permeable surface. So whenever a particle goes across, it sort of gets stripped off. So now you have Poisson fluctuations in that number of particles that go across. So imagine you have a high fluctuation. More particles go across, they get stripped off. So now you have lost more mass on an average. There's a consequence, the subperiod is going to reviralize, and it's going to puff up a little bit more than average, and therefore the tidal radius moves in a little bit more further than average, and therefore the next time step, I lose a little bit more than average, and you get this runaway instability. And it's completely driven by discreteness noise, and it's amplified in the presence of this tidal field, and basically that's what gives rise to all this mess. And the only thing you can do about it is go to more larger n. It has nothing to do with softening. But softening does play another role, in that every time, even with 1 million particles, if you make your softening too large, you just see that all these guys just, boop, they sort of disrupt artificially. How does this compare to what simulations, cosmological simulations? So you go to a Millennium simulation, okay? And in the Millennium simulation, a subperiod at accretion about 30,000 particles has a softening about 0.1 times the scale radius. Okay? For 300,000 particles, it becomes a factor 2 smaller. So this is roughly the band in which halos are resolved in the Millennium simulation. And you see that even a subhalo in the Millennium with 1 million particles will be in this regime, and they just go, woof, they disrupt artificially. Okay? So the upshot is we have explored a huge area of parameter space, different orbital energies and all this stuff, and numerical parameters, time stepping, the opening angle of your tree. None of these make any effect. You're clearly dominated by n and epsilon. And the upshot is no matter what we do, no matter what orbit we pick, if we integrate with enough resolution, we never, ever find subperiod disruption. Disclaimer, this is no baryonic effects and no dynamical friction. Like dynamical friction may actually be important. Okay. The evolution instead of substructures suffers from two problems. There's this discreteness driven runaway instability, which basically kicks in whenever you have about 1,000 particles. Okay, so whenever you hit about 1,000 particles, you start to see these things diverge. So you just don't use subperiods below 1,000 particles. So, okay. Now, most people just use subperiods down to 50 particles because that's where they find convergence in the subperiod mass function, but whatever. And you have a lot of artificial disruption due to overmerging, due to oversoftening. Okay, so basically the problem really is getting things right inside about 15-20% of the virial radius. That's where the tidal field is strong, and it's really, really hard to get the dynamics right. So why do we care in this meeting about that? Well, for example, one application is a paper that appeared today by Duncan Campbell at Yale. It's related to what we call the clustering crisis. So what we see here are correlation functions, WP, in three different mass bins, in black from Sloan, and overplotted are five different well-known models. Okay, the first thing you can do is you can just do the standard rank order matching of stellar mass to M peak. Okay, we heard about that. When you do that, you basically get the orange line, and you underpredict clustering on small scales. Nothing new, has been shown before. If instead you do abundance matching onto V peak, you get the green line and you get a good fit. Okay? Rachel Reddick showed that very nicely and advocated, therefore, use V peak, and most of you jump on the bandwagon and use V peak, which I will show in a minute has its own problems. But there are some other models that are forward modeling, empirical models by Ben Moster and Xiao Yang and Peter Baruzzi, and they never really compare the results directly to the clustering. But those models, by construction, very nicely fit the evolution in the stellar mass function over time. That's what they were constructed to do. Okay? And those models, though, have exactly the same problem as the rank matching onto mass models. They only predict the clustering. And the core reason for that is they basically all underpredict the satellite fraction of galaxies as a function of stellar mass. So this is from, the data is from the group catalog, from Sloan, from Xiaoyang et al. And then the V-peak matching miraculously get it right, and so that's why they get the small-scale clustering right. Okay. So your take of this might be, okay, well, then just use V-peak, then be done with it. V-max, okay, central potential, that clearly sets the properties of the galaxies, and we're done. There is a problem, though, and that's the following. If you take that V-peak model at face value, I don't know, some of you claim you shouldn't do that, but now what it basically means is that what you do is you link stellar mass to V-peak, and V-peak for different halos happens at a different redshift, Z-peak. And therefore, since that Z-peak does not go into recipe, effectively what you are assuming, if you want to claim consistency, is that the V-peak stellar mass relation does not evolve at redshift. That's inherently what you basically assume. So if you make that assumption, what you can then do is you can go and look at the Vmax histories of halos. How does Vmax of a halo grow over time? And use that V-peak as stellar mass relation to work out how do galaxies grow in stellar mass over time. If you do that, you get these solid lines here. These different colors correspond to different final halo mass or final V-peak. And you see that in this RV model, this rank order V-peak matching model, all stellar masses grow very early on and almost all the same. Whereas if you look at a model like Van Master's model, which actually fits the evolution in the stellar mass function with redshift, you get these lines, and we see that low mass systems assemble late, right? And massive systems assemble earlier, aka downsizing, or whatever you want to call it. But this fits the stellar mass function. This cannot fit the stellar mass function. In fact, if you actually use this model to predict what the stellar mass functions look like at different redshifts, you get the green curves. You vastly overpredict the mass. So the V-peak model at face value is not a physical description of the universe. So there's four potential solutions that we discussed in the paper. One is there's evolution in the Vmax-M star relation. Now, we did not explore that option. Okay? We believe, we argue, speculate, but it might not work easily. But we really wanted to focus on what do you need to do to salvage your mass-based abundance matching. And there's basically two things you can do. You can either say, well, satellites need to grow after they fall in. Their stellar mass is not just set at their peak value, and then they just stop doing anything. They still continue to grow as a satellite. Okay? And Wetzel has given us a good argument that at least for about 2 to 4 gigayears, they should continue to grow in stellar mass. So we played with models like that, and it helps, but we find the effect not strong.
So the halos are dominating the other parts, not where you're looking. So the halo mass function doesn't care about...
But the very large fraction of sub-halos has a perisyner that comes inside 15 to 20% of the very rays, almost the vast majority of them.
No.
Oh, vast majority, no. 50%.
No. If you look in Aquarius, that's just not...
Because all those are dead, got disrupted.
Sorry?
Artificially.
This what? No.
The usual count of sub-halos donated by him to the foreman recently, and they haven't yet gone through this 10% stripping.
That's because the surviving sub-halos all came in yesterday, because the ones that came in before were artificially disrupted.
Because he looked at what happened, so there's not a count today. When you count out to the mirror rings, which is what people usually do, it's still dominated by things that came in recently.
Let's carry it on later for lunch. Let's thank Frank again.